I am Bruce Thiemann, and I live in East Peoria.
And Thiemann is spelled?
T-H-I-E-M-A-N-N.
Okay. And for the conversation, we can just have the conversation and we'll forget the lights and the camera here.
So, okay.
You grew up where and when and things like that?
Yeah, I grew up on the East Bluff of Peoria, up by Von Steuben Playground. And I went to Von Steuben Grade School and then Woodruff High School and graduated in the class of 67 from Woodruff. So kind of grew up in the 50s, late 50s, early 60s.
Did you know Bill Martin in high school?
Yes. Bill was a legendary character in high school. I'm sure he won't mind me saying this, but he was a legendary tough guy in high school. He won the award at Woodruff called the Don Shaver Award for the best blocker and tackler on the football team. And he may have won it 2 years in a row. The Don Shaver Award, by the way, was named after Don Shaver, who was killed in action in Korea, and had been a Woodruff graduate and had been a tremendous athlete at Woodruff. And
so you went to Woodruff High School, graduated, and
yes.
Then what did you do?
I started college like a lot of guys in 67 because if you didn't have an acceptance to college, you got drafted right away. And I came from a family where it was kind of expected you'd go to college. I was thinking I wanted to go to Vietnam, but my parents, of course, said, no, you're going to go to college. And I thought this is going to be the only war of my generation. And, I could see it starting to peak. And I knew I probably wouldn't finish college, but kind of to please my mom and dad, I started college.
And you went to what college and how long?
I started at Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Iowa. It's kind of a college like a Grinnell or a Knox. It was thought of as part of what they called the Ivy League of the Midwest. And it was a small, good school, but only went there for a semester. And found it was a little too small for me. It was a little too isolated. So I came back to Peoria, and then I went to ISU my second semester down in Normal. And then I joined the Army.
was there a particular reason that you decided after 1 year of college that it was time to join the Army, despite your parents' interest that you finish college?
Well, it was 1968. And they had the Tet Offensive, and after the Tet Offensive in 68, the national press, the national mood, there was kind of a sense that I got that the country was starting to give up its support of Vietnam, the cause. And I thought, well, they're going to start pulling people out, and it's going to all wind down. And if I stay in college and finish college, it'll be over. By the time I get back, by the time I got out of college. And
when did you go into the service? Where was basic training? Where was AIT? What kind of MOS did you have?
I joined from Bloomington. I was at ISU finishing up the semester, and we had these great arguments in the dorm about Vietnam. Of course, it was the big topic of discussion.
The Tet Offensive was that semester?
I think it was, yeah, that spring semester of 68. And so the thought was that it was unfair for certain people to get deferments, certain people to get drafted. And of course, we were all people who were not drafted. And so the thought was, well, if you really believe that that's unfair, you ought to go join. And so after a few discussions like that, I went down to the recruiting office in Bloomington and joined up because I wanted to go anyway. And that was just kind of the last prompt to get me down there. Of course, when I told my folks in Peoria that I had enlisted from Bloomington, they thought I was really foolish. And their whole idea was, my dad had been through World War II. His idea was, why would you want to go to a place where you could get hurt? And now that I'm a parent myself, I can easily understand, the advice they were giving me. I don't think I would have wanted my children to join and go to a place where battles were going on, but that was the kind of kid I was at that time. And
Your MOS was in?
I started out, you know, as a two-year enlistee. I kind of volunteered for the draft, so they gave you a dream sheet. You probably remember this because you were in about the same time. And you put down what you wanted to do in the service.
None of which happened.
Right. And so I put down combat photographer in Vietnam. I had this romantic idea of Hemingway, you know, and war being kind of a thing that was gallant and, you know, would test your mettle. And I think that's all I put down. So, of course, that was unavailable. I don't think I ever met a combat photographer, actually, in Vietnam. But I was a good student. And the Army was full of people who had been drafted that didn't have much education. So I scored well on all the tests, and so they sent me to MP school in Fort Gordon, Georgia. Didn't want to be there. Told the commanders that I did not want to be an MP because I thought I'd be stateside for a couple of years. Had to go in front of a board, had a lot of arguing, and they finally threw the book down and said, okay, if you want to go to Vietnam, you're going to go to Vietnam. We're going to put you in infantry, and you're going to go straight to Vietnam. And I said, that's what I joined for. You know, they couldn't understand it either, because that was late 1968. And again, even people in the Army were like avoiding Vietnam. You know, Vietnam was not a place you wanted to go to, even if you were in the Army. A lot of those guys had come back from Vietnam, and they again, like my parents, they said, you know, you're pretty foolish. You don't know what you're getting into. But I was young and dumb, and that was my goal. And so I sat and waited for orders. And again, they didn't give me orders for infantry. They gave me orders for a helicopter mechanic school in Virginia at Fort Eustis. So I got there and I went through the same spiel, you know, I don't want to be a helicopter mechanic. I just want to go to Vietnam, send me back to infantry school. And there was a major there who was smarter than I was. And he said, hey, you know what? Most of the helicopters are actually in Vietnam. Why don't you stay here and knuckle down? I can pretty much guarantee you'll get to Vietnam. And once you're there, you can do whatever you want. You know, they're always looking for volunteers. So you
went over to Vietnam as a mechanic for helicopters?
As a crew chief, actually. Yeah, I was, again, because I had good aptitude for book learning and classrooms, I rose up to the head of my training unit. So they promoted me even before I went over to what they call the crew chief status. So that when I got to Vietnam, I was my MOS was a crew chief MOS, which I think was 69N20, if I recall. So I got to Vietnam and went to the typical Long Bin holding area there, and then within a few days got orders for a air cav unit, which was down in Vinh Long, Vietnam. And it was called the 7th Squadron of the 1st Air Cavalry Regiment. It was an old cavalry unit that they dusted off and reconstituted and made it into an air cav unit. But it had this history of being a regular cavalry unit all through the Army history.
So you became, you say, an air cav unit. What did you do when you got there? I mean, what was the transition?
Because you
were being trained as a mechanic.
Right, I got down there, and they said, well, we're going to put you on the flight line, and you can work on the helicopters, you know, that come back from the missions every day. Because every morning around dawn or before dawn, the units would take off. The base at Vinh Long had probably, you know, five or six different helicopter units, some air cav units and some helicopter standalone units, So I did that for a couple of weeks, and it was kind of hot, kind of boring. And I said, I want to go off with these guys every morning on these missions. They said, well, you got to volunteer for that. So I went and volunteered for it, and they said, we don't have any openings for crew chiefs, but we got some openings for door gunners on the slicks. And so I volunteered to do that. And then eventually openings came up to be a crew chief on a slick. And what that meant was that you got to sit on the left side and manned the left gun versus the door gunner who sat on the right side and he manned the right gun. But it also meant when you landed that you could work on the helicopter a little bit. You fueled it up, you tightened up all the loose stuff, you checked it out, and you got to sign the logbook, and you kind of got assigned one particular helicopter. And that was kind of your bird. And then they would have a pilot, usually a warrant officer or a lieutenant, and he was the aircraft commander. So he was assigned to one particular helicopter. And then the door gunners would kind of rotate. You might have one for a month or two. And then the other pilot, who they called him the pilot, he would rotate. But the aircraft commander and the crew chief kind of got together on the same ship. And that was kind of nice because I got to serve with two warrant officers for long periods of time and got to know them pretty well.
And their names were?
Jim Boyle was the first one. He was a fellow from Georgia, excellent pilot. And the second one was Randy Wagner, and he was from New York State, another excellent pilot. And when you flew every day and you were flying constantly, you got to really get the feel of who were the good pilots in the unit and who were, you know, you could be confident enough to lay down and take a nap while they were flying the ship.
You stay in contact with either one of them?
Yes. Randy Wagner sent to me the piece off the top of the helicopter, the same helicopter that he and I were on, assigned to, which was, the helicopter was called Dutch Master 680. And I've got a...
we'll show a picture of
it. Yeah, I've got some pictures of it. And this was the nut that held everything down in the helicopter. And if you don't mind me using the vernacular, it was called the Jesus nut, because if it ever came off, you would meet Jesus if you'd been good in life. And this is a really tough piece of metal. And if you can read the top of it, it says 1968, where it was heat treated and baked. His tour of duty lasted a little longer than mine. The pilots would usually fly for 6 months, and then they would do 6 months of ground duty, like operational assignments. And so he started his 6 months a little before my last 6 months, a little afterwards, actually. So he stayed, and he said a couple of months after I left and came home, they got into a battle, and the ship got shot up quite a bit and had to be kind of gone over, and they decided to take the Jesus nut off. And so they gave it to him, and he brought it home. And I go to a couple of the reunions every once in a while of the unit and run into these pilots, and so that's where I got the Jesus nut. He loaned it to me for 10 years as a paperweight.
10 years and then return it.
I got to return it to him in 10 years.
So when you talk about door gunner and the pilot and the chief warrant officer, etc., you went out as a unit, four people in the helicopter.
Right.
What were your duties?
Well, my duties on the slick were to make sure that the door gunner had armed the ship in the morning, make sure the guns were on the ship, make sure the ship was gassed up, make sure the logbook was kept up to date, make sure the ship mechanically was okay, that because the ships were constantly being checked out at the end of every day. A lot of times we would be flying along and a stray bullet would hit the ship, and the ships were so loud that it was hard to know, you know, if you got shot. And so one of the jobs was to check the ship out thoroughly every night to see if there was any new bullet holes in it. And if there were, to tell the mechanics about it and, you know, whether it needed to be repaired or just put some tape over it. And but the ships went out in a complement of other ships. So our slick was one of four or five slicks. We had a couple of gunships that went with us, either Cobras or Huey gunships, mainly Cobras towards the latter part of it. And then there were small ships called Loaches, light observation helicopters. And we would go out our flight would go out with all those helicopters, and then we would join other flights of helicopters, and we would all meet somewhere and pick up troops, and we get our assignments. And but before we left, we knew that we were going to do missions that day, maybe in Kamau, which was a certain area, or Sok Trang, which was another area, or Kanto, or any of these places, and it might be an hour and a half to get there. So all the ships would load up in the morning with all their fuel and ammunition, and then we would fly for maybe an hour, hour and a half, we'd land, and then we would work with the commanders to pick up the infantry. And then the assignment would be to insert the infantry wherever they thought the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese were, in these LZs that they had picked out or were picking out that day.
The landing zones?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you would go back and pick them up after a certain amount of time?
Yes. Yeah, we always brought them out at the end of the day. Sometimes it was late in the day. Sometimes if they couldn't find much activity, we'd pick them up and then reinsert them in the afternoon somewhere else. And so we did a lot of in what they called insertions. And quite a few times they were called hot LZs, and that was the most fun, when you could go in with the guns blazing. And you know, there was a lot of excitement to it. The LZs would be marked, and it was thought that there was enemy there. And so you would go in as fast as you could, as low as you could above the treetops, and at the last minute the pilots would flare the ship up, which kind of stops the ship in the air, and then settle it down close to the ground, and then the airwaves would be full of, you know, get the troops off, get the troops off, you know, and you'd stop firing while the troops were jumping off, although some of the troops would start firing on their own, especially if fire was coming from the tree lines. And then all this was happening with ships all around you doing the same thing, behind you, in front of you, sometimes to the right and left, depending on how big the LZs were. And then the pilots would try to get out of there as quick as possible. And with the troops off, the ships would be a little bit lighter, and they could pull all the pitch in, all the strength of the ship, and tip it forward and pull it up as fast and as high and kind of rotate it out of the LZ as quick as possible. Those were the times when the ship was most vulnerable, when you were slow and near the ground.
You used the term fun and exciting. In what capacity are you using the word fun and exciting when you're talking about guns blazing, dropping off troops with enemy fire coming in?
It's a capacity of distant memory. it's from being a long ways from it. I'm sure at the time I was terrified, petrified. I think everybody was, and although you did get used to it after a while, but. Now that I look back on it, I'm thinking that was really exciting. And, you know, if you read books about Vietnam, you constantly hear people talk about, you know, insertions in hot LZs being a high adrenaline kind of a rush. And,
what was the most difficult insertion that you participated in?
We were taking troops down to the Yumin Forest one time, and this was an area that was just full of the enemy, down the southern part of Vietnam. It was swampy, brushy, there were trees, there was a lot of water, and it was a real small LZ. And as we were going in, one of our small helicopters got shot down. And when we dropped our troops off, we were directed over to try to get it out of there because we had a hook on the bottom of our helicopter. And we had enough power that we could drop a sling down. And while we were doing that, we started getting shot, taking fire. And as we were picking up this other helicopter, our fuel started to spurt out the sides. I sat on the left side and the fuel tank was right next to me. And I looked down, and it was like a little garden hose of JP-4, which was the fuel. And the pilot said, "I think we're taking hits." I said, "Yeah, we just got hit in the fuel cell right here." And he said, "Oh, how bad is it?" And I said, "Well, it's about the size of a garden hose." And he said, "I think we can get out of here, but not very far." And so we got the other helicopter up in the air. We went a short distance, and we all came down fast, and that was really exciting. And
did it occur to you, you keep using the term exciting, and did it occur to you that you were this far from injury or worse?
Yeah, you know, but I thought I was kind of invulnerable. I was sitting on a plate. When helicopters would crash, we would scavenge the armor plates, because the pilots actually had an armored seat they sat in. They had sliding panels, and they sat, and the whole seat was armored, and they had a, even up to the, almost up to the, to where their neck would start. And so when we had ships that got shot down and we could access them, we would scavenge pieces of those armor plates, especially the sliding side panels. And then we would make our own little armored area. We would put a piece down on the floor, a piece behind us, a piece on our left, maybe sit on another one. And then we wore a chicken plate. And so we kind of thought of ourselves as being protected pretty well. I mean, you know, we weren't entirely protected, but it gave you a feeling of some protection.
And a chicken plate would be what?
A chicken plate was a vest that had armor plating on it to kind of fit around your midsection from here on down to here. And they supposedly could stop a 30 caliber round. And one of my pictures here is my pilot, Wagner, the second pilot, and he's pointing to the hole in his chicken plate that stopped a round. One day, a bullet came up through the bubble and hit him right in the chest. That chicken plate stopped it. So, what we worried about was the 51 caliber rounds and the RPGs and the, you know, the bigger stuff than the normal 30 cal. And
were you ever injured?
I wasn't. I a couple of times there were fragments of explosives going on around us, and but never injured to the point where I had to get stitches or anything. You know, just cuts and abrasions and things like that.
How long were you in country?
1 year and 2 days, and I stayed 2 extra days so I could get that early out. Remember, back then, if you were just a 2 year enlistee or draftee, after you did your training and went to NAM, you only had 3 months or so left, and so they would give you a early out up to 150 days, but you had to arrive in the States with less than 150 days, so I stayed a couple extra days.
We've been talking about a variety of helicopters. What kind of helicopter did you fly on?
It was a UH-1H. It was made by a company called Bell in Texas, and they called them Slicks because they had the ability to carry troops, and they were not a complete gunship. They had machine guns on the sides, but they were designed more to ferry troops. And sometimes we did medevac duty. Sometimes we made supply runs, and it was kind of a utility helicopter, but the main purpose was to take troops.
And how many troops could you carry?
Well, if they were Americans, only about 9. If they were Vietnamese, it was like 12 or 13. And weight was a big factor.
You say you carried Vietnamese troops, too. So you were ferrying Arvin troops?
Yes. As I thought, when I got to Vietnam, I thought, you know, I'm the worst peaking out here. And sure enough, after about 5 months in country, working with the 9th Infantry, which was located down in the Mekong Delta where we were, they told the 9th Infantry, you're going to go back to Hawaii. That was the first unit that was pulled out. And so after that, we had to work with the Arvin soldiers.
Did you have any friends who were injured or lost their lives in Vietnam?
I did, yeah. And that was the sad part of it was, they were really good guys who, you know, would have made a contribution if they'd come back. What I found out about the air crews, and I never knew this because I just kind of happened into it, was they had a lot of esprit de corps. They had a lot of camaraderie, the flying together. And the pilots kind of accepted the crew. So there wasn't the hierarchy of that you sometimes find in the military where the officers didn't want to have anything to do with the enlisted men, and the enlisted men thought the officers were, you know, above them or something. When you're all up in the air together on the helicopter, all working together, it developed a lot of camaraderie. And so you get to know people pretty well. And everybody that I flew with, I thought were, you know, people with a lot of integrity, a lot of capacity, a lot of bravery, good people.
Most of your insertions were in the southern portion of Vietnam, the southern portion of South Vietnam?
Yes.
The Delta area?
Yeah, it was called Four Corps. In fact, I never even got to Saigon, which, you know, I really wanted to do, and maybe I'll go back someday, but it was all way down south in the Mekong Delta, where the Mekong River spreads out into a bunch of smaller rivers and then spreads out into a bunch of smaller canals. And we did a lot of work up on the Cambodian border, where there's some mountainous areas. Nui Ba Din is a famous mountain up there, and then a group of mountains called the Seven Sisters.
Did you, other than transporting ARVN troops, did you have any interaction with the South Vietnamese army?
No. Our base was mainly all American troops, American helicopter units. We had some infantry on the base. They guarded the base and did some missions in the local area. Once a month we got a day off and could go into town. We were next to a town, of maybe a couple thousand people anyway, and could relax in town a little bit. So I had some ability to, go into town and see how the Vietnamese lived. And
One day a month,
yeah. Yeah, the one thing that's easy to forget about Vietnam, and you probably remember this, they worked you hard. I mean, we were up before dawn. We came back after dark a lot. We got not a lot of sleep, and it was 7 days, you know. There wasn't a day off every 7 days. It was...
My recollection was you didn't know what day it was.
Yeah.
You have a Vietnam veteran shirt on. You have your dog tags. You're proud of your service.
I am now, but I wasn't when I came back. And I wish I had saved more parts of the uniform I brought back. But I came back to Peoria in the spring of 1970, and nobody was talking about how proud they were to be a Vietnam veteran. I kind of just got rid of almost everything that I'd brought back, except the dog tags. And then in the late 70s and early 80s, particularly the early 80s, I started to get together with other Vietnam veterans. Probably met you around then, and we formed this group called the Vietnam Veterans of Illinois, and started to just buy stuff like this Vietnam shirt and, you know, wear it once or twice a year around Memorial Day and Veterans Day, started marching the parades, and it made me feel a lot better to do that.
How long did it take you to come to grips with being able to talk about your service?
I'd say about 10 years, really. I mean, I felt like I had been reckless. I felt like I hadn't thought it out completely. When I got there, I did enjoy the missions, and I enjoyed the adrenaline and the rush from it all, but I knew we were causing a lot of havoc out in the countryside out there, and these people, this was their home. I mean, when you're doing missions and you see people tending to fields to the right and left, walking around, conducting their daily activities, you know, and you're inserting troops down the road in some tree line and shooting up the countryside, and everywhere that we looked down from the helicopter, there were shell craters, and the whole countryside was shot up by the time I got there, and we shot it up a lot worse. And I got home, I started thinking, you know, maybe the people that were anti-war were on the right side of it. Maybe it was kind of a reckless thing for the country to do and for we that went over there to do individually.
With time, did that perception change?
It did, yeah. And what I saw over the years was that the Vietnamese that got out of there, and I met a few in Peoria, they said the Americans coming was the best thing that ever happened to them, and that the country fell apart as soon as we left, and they went into almost like the Dark Ages after that, and whatever little bit of liberty, whatever little bit of free market, whatever little bit of success they were having, all ended when this totalitarian communist regime, you know, ended up putting its stamp on South Vietnam, and they've still got them in a yoke, I think. I can't think of any really good news that's come out of either South Vietnam or North Vietnam since the North Vietnamese took over the whole country. So looking back in hindsight, I think it would have been better had we just won the war completely, and Vietnam, the entire country, had become like a Japan or like a South Korea, you know, a prosperous country with freedom and free elections. And
you came back in 68.
70.
I'm sorry,
yeah,
70. Yeah, you went in 68.
Yeah, yeah.
And you mentioned VVI.
Yeah.
What other organizations have you participated in? Why do you feel the need to support veterans' issues?
I liked being around veterans. It kind of got me into it. The high school I went to, Woodruff, had a lot of veterans, and a lot of them were still around Peoria, and so I kind of enjoyed their company, and I knew a lot of them, and so that made it comfortable. And then as I met veterans from Central and Spaulding and Richwoods, and people that were living in Peoria that were veterans, it just became kind of a wider circle of being comfortable. And it seemed like being around each other made us all feel better. And talking about our experiences in Vietnam and being able to take some pride in it with people who had kind of been there, done that, and I think it was a healing process. I'm sure I wasn't the only person that came back from Vietnam conflicted. I'm sure I wasn't the only person that came back feeling like, you know, you hadn't done the right thing, you hadn't done enough, or that you had some kind of issues with your service. So all of us getting together, I think it was a big benefit to us. And
what organizations have you been participating in?
Living in East Peoria, I found they had a really active VFW. It's called Post 2778, I think.
2078.
Yeah. So I was active in that for quite a while, and they raised a lot of money for local causes. And then a bunch of veterans who had been in different posts, including the VVI, thought, you know, there's just too much pettiness among the different veterans organizations. Like, maybe you couldn't join the VFW unless you had a certain type of service. Or maybe you didn't want to be in the Legion because you thought they were older guys that looked down on your service. And so you'll remember this. We came up with the idea of a umbrella group that would bring all the veterans organizations together at least once a year and have what we called the Veterans Ball. And we would use that group also to raise money for good purposes, and it was called 92 Bravo, and one of the purposes we came up with was to start junior ROTC programs at all the high schools. They called them junior ROTC or JROTC programs, and they needed some startup capital. So I was proud to work with you and a lot of other Vietnam vets and some older vets too, Korean vets and World War II vets, and we had maybe a dozen of those veterans balls, and they were fun. To some degree, I think they allowed the different veterans groups in town to come together at least for a night.
You came back You've been involved in veterans organizations. You've actually spoken at a couple of events. Why did you feel, I mean, you were asked probably, but why did you feel compelled to say, yes, I have something to offer?
Well, again, after I kind of got to a point where I started feeling like the whole effort was not in vain, I came up with an argument and kind of turned it into a speech, which I called Vietnam Was Not in Vain. And it gave me a positive feeling to give that speech. And I talked about the good that the Americans did when they were over there, and talked about how the effort was not a complete lost cause. And when I give that speech, people would come up afterwards, especially veterans, and they would say, thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed hearing that. It was great to hear. But after hearing it two or three times, they said, Bruce, can you have a new speech next time? So I came up with a second speech, which I have given often in the area. But if asked, I'll come up with a third speech because I like talking to veterans. And sometimes the parents will come up, and the siblings or the wives. We're all getting older now, even the kids. And this idea of being proud of your service—that's the theme. And I'm glad to help with that.
Let's talk about your personal life when you got back. Your family wanted you to go to college, so you did.
Yep.
Where did you go? And tell me to your professional career.
Yeah, I had to be accepted at a college to get that early out we talked about, and ICC had just started, so I knew they were accepting everybody.
Illinois Central College.
Yeah, Illinois Central College, and then I had a friend that said Hiram Walkers was hiring veterans, and so I got a job working second shift at Hiram Walkers, and I got accepted at ICC, and I went days to ICC and did that for a year and a half or so till I ran out of credits I could get at Illinois Central, and then I transferred to Bradley, and living in different parts of Peoria. I had a lot of fun. I lived down on North Madison with some guys from high school that were still single. Some of them were veterans, and then we moved up to Lynn Street. We had a place called the Lynn Street Crazy House. It's kind of like a frat house. Only most of us were working or going to school part-time, and then down to Main Street. There was a couple big apartment houses on the Main Street hill, and kind of let my hair grow out, and just enjoyed the relaxed lifestyle of the 1970s in Peoria, but eventually ran out of places I could go in Peoria. So in the mid-70s, I went down to Carbondale and lived in Carbondale for a couple of years, and went to SIU, and I finally got a degree. I was a lazy scholar, and I was getting credits, you know. I was using the GI Bill, used it all, but it took me 5 years to get that history degree from Carbondale. But then I didn't want to leave school.
And what do you do with a history degree other than teach history?
Yeah, and I was 25, and I wasn't ready to settle down and do something. So somebody suggested taking the LSAT, the law school admission test, and I took that and did okay on it. Kind of surprised myself. And again, they were looking for vets. You know, they wanted to fill their quota of vets. I found that a lot of places, if you told them you were a veteran and told them you were a Vietnam veteran, they wanted to kind of help you along. And I got help. Probably got me into a lot of schools that wouldn't have accepted me otherwise.
And where did you go for law school?
So at that point, I had been to Cornell College in Iowa. I had been to Illinois State University. I'd been to Illinois Central College, I'd been to Bradley, and I'd been to the Southern Illinois University. And that was my undergraduate studies. And SIU had just started a law school. And they had just started, and they said, you might be able to get in here because you're graduating from SIU. You did okay on the LSAT. They're looking for warm bodies. And so they accepted me. And I was just kind of, again, loafing around Carbondale, living in a trailer out on the edge of campus out there. And the books were really expensive, and I wasn't a serious student, so I didn't buy any books. I didn't buy any law school books. And that the professors noticed it, the other classmates noticed it. So they called me Wingo. And that was the best nickname I ever had, Wingo. They said, you're just winging it. And so the professors said, if you're serious about it, you better buy books. If not, get out of here. And so after a year, I transferred out. And I had a friend out in Boston, and they told me about a law school out there that would probably accept anybody who could pay the tuition, called the New England School of Law. You've probably never heard of it. But it was across the river from Harvard and down the street from MIT, and it was on Newbury Street near Copley Plaza. It was in downtown Boston. Boston's a great town, and so I stayed there and went to school for a year, got some more credits, and then somebody told me about a school called American University that would accept transfer students in Washington, D.C., and of course, my second year, I bought books and did pretty well. And so I had enough of an academic record to get accepted to American University, and I finished up down there. Their college is called the Washington College of Law of the American University, and it's a good school, but I was only, in the bottom third of my class, and I applied all over the East Coast for jobs, applied everywhere, and could not get a job offer anywhere. Probably sent out 100 resumes and job offers. And so I thought I'll come back to Peoria and look around, and got a job here.
Do you think that your tour in Vietnam impacted your attitude about education in any way?
It did. I was always a believer in learning by doing. And of course, anytime you're around a lot of equipment, as you do more, your confidence level goes up. So handling the machine gun every day, handling the helicopter to some degree, some of these long runs we do, either going or coming to the AOs, the areas of operation, the pilots, they were young guys. I mean, I was 20, but a lot of the pilots were 22 or 23. There was a lot of drinking in Vietnam, and they were old enough to go to the PX and buy booze. They'd be a little hungover in the mornings. They would say, hey, can you crawl up here into the seat? And I want to crawl into the back and sleep. And there were two pilots. There was the aircraft commander and the pilot. So I'd crawl up into the seat, and after a while, I'd be talking to the guy who was flying the ship, and he'd be showing me, yeah, this does this, and this does this, and this does this, and why don't you try it? So you put your feet on the pedals, put your hand on the sticks, watch the bubbles and all the altimeters and stuff. And even though we were kind of in formations, it was a real loose formation. So there's plenty of room between you and all the other helicopters. And pretty soon the radio would crackle and some other pilot would say, is your crew chief flying your helicopter? You're porpoising all over the place. What's going on over there? Because it's actually pretty hard to keep a helicopter going straight and level. But
so you learned to fly a helicopter by doing, and everything
I did,
by
yeah.
doing.
Yeah, yeah.
In your personal life, you're married, have a family?
Yes, son and a daughter that are raised, and now have been blessed with grandchildren. So my son Bob Tiemann is in the community, works at Methodist. He's married to Andrea. And they blessed us with Levon, our grandson, and Rory, our granddaughter. And my daughter, Maggie Tiemann Rush, is in the community, married a fellow from Metamora. And it's a lot of fun to be gramps.
You've been promoted.
Yeah.
you have your AirCav hat. May I call it an AirCav hat?
Yeah, I was lucky. The unit I got sent to, and when you go to Vietnam, halfway through the war, they're just, you're just filling in. These units are already there. People you may have interviewed before may have gotten over there in 65 or 66 when units were first getting there, and whole units would go over together on ships, and they would wade off the ship onto the beach just like World War II. In our case, this unit that I ended up joining had gotten to Vietnam years earlier, several years earlier, and they had formed in Fort Knox, Kentucky. That's where the 1st Air Cavalry Regiment, that's their home base, for lack of a better word. And once they got all their full complement of officers and helicopters, they flew the helicopters across the United States down through El Paso. I guess that's the lowest area of the Rockies you can fly them across. They flew them to Long Beach. They dismantled them, put them on ships, and they took the whole unit over there, all the helicopters, all the equipment. And then they went to a place called Zion for a couple of years, and they went down to Vinh Long in 1968, and they set up a camp there along with these other helicopter companies. And so when I joined them, they had all these cavalry traditions, and one of the cavalry traditions is that you wear a cav hat. And so this cav hat is kind of a neat thing. Makes you look good, makes you taller. And people recognize it. They say, hey, that guy was in the cav.